Well, I want to thank y'all for allowing me to come out today and talk on this topic. Education is very, I'm very passionate about education because I think that that's the only way that we can actually help those is if they know what to look for and how they can help not only themselves but also the people around them, their friends, their family. I guarantee you everybody in here knows someone who's suffering from depression or has suffered from depression. One of the questions I would be asking if I was sitting in your place right now is she even a Christian? And the answer is yes. And I can tell you without a doubt that God put me in this position to help people. And I know that. I may not know anything else 100%, but that I know. So I hope he uses me today to help someone, if not multiple people. So we're going to talk today about, are you stressed or are you depressed? Because there is a difference. So one thing is whenever we think about stress, we think about it in a negative way. But stress is not always negative. It can actually be good and bad. And some examples of that, as far as it being good, is stress is basically our body's response to something that is affecting us in a negative way. Maybe that's a difficult circumstance, or maybe it's just an adverse event. So the way that it can actually help us in a good way is it will often help us help motivate us. So if anybody in the room is a procrastinator and you have a work deadline, that stress of not meeting the deadline and perhaps losing your job is what motivates you to get the work done. It also is what we see often in the flight or fight response. Whenever we're in danger, then our body's natural response that God gave it puts us into flight or fight mode and helps us survive in that situation. And that's just a few of the examples. There's also many others, but those are just a few. Now, that God just meant those things for us to be, to help us in short spurts of when we need it. When we're in danger, we either fight or flight. But because of our very busy lives and everything that overwhelms us from day to day, a lot of times stress becomes chronic. And when it becomes chronic, it starts affecting us in a negative way and can actually make us very sick. And so these are just a couple of the things that are associated with chronic stress. We actually see physical changes, such as increased blood pressure. It suppresses our immune system, which then, of course, increases our risk of becoming ill with other things. It increases our heart rate. It can increase our risk of stroke, cause digestive problems. If you had a gastroenterologist here, they would confirm that they get many consults from other physicians or patients just walking in their office saying, something's wrong with me, you need to scope me because I'm sick, I'm having diarrhea, my stomach hurts all the time. They do these extensive tests only to find nothing. And then they send them to me and say that it's stress. And I only mention that because it tells you how much stress can actually impact your body and the response that your body has. Another thing that it does is it can lead to depression, which is obviously what we're going to talk about tonight. And it also increases consumption of alcohol as well as drugs because people use that as a way to cope. Some of the common causes, I know nobody real here needs me to list causes. I'm sure you have plenty of your own. But the number one is work. And I assume that's because that's where we spend most of our time. So maybe they dislike their job, or maybe they just dislike their manager. And in today's economy, the companies are downsizing. And so they are taking two jobs and putting them into one. So the person now has to do the jobs of two people. So that obviously adds additional stress. Shift workers, we see this a lot in those who work different shifts because it messes up their sleep cycle and also causes additional stress within their family, specifically with their relationships with their children and their spouse, because a lot of times they're sleeping when their family is up in activities and they don't feel like they're really included in the family unit. Life changes can also cause a great deal of stress. Death of a loved one, getting married. If anybody in here has ever planned a wedding, you will confirm that that is very stressful. And it's also financially stressing, not just emotionally. And having children, and even though these are usually joyous events, there's a lot of stress that's associated with them. We also find that those who have an increase in medical illness are at an increased risk of stress and depression. And as our population is aging, we also are seeing a great deal of stress associated with the children of those who are aging because they're having to care for their loved ones. And unfortunately, the rest of their life stays just as busy as it was beforehand, but now they're also caring for their aging parent or family member. So some of this was mentioned earlier, The common signs and symptoms, as I mentioned, the one almost to the bottom, the physical symptoms, the nausea, diarrhea, chest pain. I mentioned gastroenterologists, but cardiologists actually also see a lot of these patients. They'll come in, they'll say, I'm having a heart attack, I just have this chest pain, I just can't get rid of it. They get an echo, they get an EKG, they get labs taken, and nothing's found. And they can't breathe, they feel like they're going to die. And chances are they're usually having some kind of panic attack that has been induced by stress of some sort. The stress, as you can also see, can cause irritability, memory problems, trouble sleeping. We've already spoke about many of these. Change in eating habits. Note these symptoms because these are also a lot of the same symptoms that I'm going to mention when we get to depression. And again, it just goes to show that when this is chronic, it can often lead to depression. The stress usually is for a short period of time. So then I ask, you know, people ask me, so how do I manage stress? So the biggest one is prayer. I tell my patients that all the time. Pray, because I definitely believe in the power of prayer. Exercise, and I know we all get sick of doctors telling us, oh, just diet and exercise, but it really does make a huge impact. What you're eating, sleep. People often undervalue the importance of sleep. And if you don't get enough sleep, it alone will make you physically ill, even if you don't have stress associated with it. And as we are getting into the holiday season, I'm actually glad that we're having this talk now, because one of the things that I find as we're getting into the holiday season is people will come into my office and I'll be all excited about Christmas and the holidays and asking them their plans. And the response that I get is not one that you would anticipate. It's usually one of dread. Then when I start speaking with them, they inform me that it's because they have so much to do, there's just not enough time to do it. So one thing that I always say is that to limit your stress, you have to learn how to say no, because just because you have an extra day where you don't have something planned doesn't mean that you should fill that day. Perhaps that's a day that you should just relax and learn how to say no. It becomes quite easy after you say it the first few times. If your house is the one where you have 40 people over every Thanksgiving and Christmas and that's kind of the tradition, it doesn't mean that you have to continue that. If you find that you are dreading it, stop doing it. And it really is that simple. Maybe it's somebody else's turn. And people will say, well, then where's everybody going to eat? Well, you'd be surprised. They will find a place to eat. And perhaps they'll be the ones that step up. From my experience, Americans never go without food. So, myself included, we'll find a place to go eat, I promise. And then, you know, after you've implemented some of these things, and I won't go over everyone, but the therapy, that is something that is very important. And a therapist is really good. I always say that everybody should go at least once a month, just because you have somebody to vent to. People say, oh, well, I vent to my husband all the time. Well, chances are he's probably not listening, and he probably gives you very limited feedback. And so the therapist is trained to help you develop coping skills to deal with the stressors that are in your life. And those stressors will, even if it's not that particular thing that happens again in the future, the skills that you learn in therapy will actually go with you for the rest of your life. Another thing is, this one right here is the one that I really want to point out, is to alter situations. Accept the things that accept that you can control certain things, but there are some things that you just cannot control. One of the things that I tell all my patients, or anybody basically who will listen to me, is that we cannot make somebody else act right. We can't make your kids act right, do right, your husband act right, do right, your wife's, or anybody. But what we do have control over is how we allow them to affect our lives. So if you have a situation in your life that is causing you stress, once it's identified, is it an adult child living in the home that doesn't want to get a job? You know, you do have control over that. It may be that means that they have to be subtly moved out, but it is something that you have control over, and it will reduce your stress. And obviously, that's just one example. So how are stress and depression different? Well, it's basically that depression is more intense, and for at least major depression, it actually lasts a full 2 weeks for most of the day. Now, when I speak about depression, people often think depression is depression, but depression is actually found in a lot of different illnesses, not just major depression, which is what we're actually going to speak about tonight. Depression is also found in dysthymic disorder, which is basically major depression for 2 consecutive years without more than 2 months. 2 consecutive months without symptoms. Depressive disorder, NOS. Bipolar disorder, which we won't talk about tonight, but some patients don't just have major depression, they also have bipolar disorder with depression. And medical problems and substances such as alcohol and drugs can also lead to depression. So what is the diagnostic criteria for major depression, which is basically what we're going to talk about tonight? That's the one that we see mostly when patients come into my office and they're suffering from depression, or I see them at the hospital. This is the one that's the diagnosed the most. So if you go to a psychiatrist, they're going to ask you all these questions. And you have to have at least 5 of these. So as I'm going through them, you just note to yourself whether or not you know someone or you yourself are having these, because if you have 5 of them, then you meet criteria for depression. Now, the one thing that you have to note is that on this one right here, you have to at least have a depressed mood or a decrease in interest, okay? So if you have one of those, if you don't have one of those, then you definitely don't meet criteria, but it doesn't mean you don't have some of the symptoms. But if you have one of those, then you just have to have 4 more of these other ones. So weight loss or gain, decrease in or increase in appetite, you either sleep too much or not enough, you have increase in agitation, loss of energy, feelings of worthlessness or excessive or inappropriate guilt. I'll have patients come in and say, I feel guilty, I don't even know why. I didn't even do anything. I just feel this guilt. And so that's one of the signs of depression, poor concentration. I also have patients come in and say, I need to be put on Ritalin because I just cannot concentrate. So then once I go into detail about their symptoms, it's not that they are having an attention problem, it's that they truly have depression. And once we treat the depression, their concentration comes back. You'll also have recurrent thoughts of death and recurrent suicidal ideations. Now, it may sound like the same thing, but they're not. Recurrent thoughts of death are, sometimes people will have thoughts of, I'm ready to go see the Lord. I just don't want to be here anymore, okay? And then there's, I'm ready to go be with the Lord, and I'm going to try to figure out a plan how I'm going to take my life. So that's the difference. But both of them are equally concerning. Now, we also see depression, sometimes we just see depression, it doesn't matter what the situation is, as far as what time of year it is, whether or not they're pregnant, not pregnant, but specifically, we often will see seasonal patterns. And as we're in the fall, going into the winter, this is important because as the days get shorter, we will see an increase in depression. We also see it along with pregnancies. So when a woman is pregnant or up to 4 weeks after she's given birth, we can see an increase in prevalence of depression. It's approximately 10 to 15%, so it's not insignificant. And obviously this can have detrimental effect to the baby and the mom. And some mothers can, and I'm sure you've heard in the news, can become quite psychotic and do some very bad things to their children. Psychotic features. So a lot of people don't associate hallucinations with depression, but the truth is you can become so depressed that you start hallucinating. And it doesn't mean that you're just necessarily you have some other psychotic disorder, it just means that your depression got so bad now you're seeing things and hearing things that other people don't see or hear. And you will actually be put on an antipsychotic, and usually when we treat the depression, then the hallucinations go away. And that's usually, that is always in severe depression. Atypical features, I mentioned these earlier, but you just have regular depression and then you have atypical depression. And so sometimes the treatment is different. That's the reason why we actually list it. Is if you have weight gain, and that's because you're eating more, you're sleeping more, and you're gaining weight. Patients will also come in and say that they have this, what we call leaden paralysis, which basically just means that they feel like their body just weighs a ton. Even their arms, it's almost like a chore just to get up out of bed because they just feel so heavy. What's the cause? Well, the truth is the cause of depression is unknown. But we do believe that there's a lot of different theories out there, and we believe that multiple factors go together to make someone depressed. We know that there is some biological differences. We also know from imaging that there are structural changes in the brain in someone who's depressed. We also know that neurotransmitters are involved, specifically serotonin. That's one of the, what I always call the feel-good chemicals in the brain. And that, if that is too low or someone is not, their brain's not utilizing it properly, then you'll see an increase in depression in those patients. Hormones. Patients who are going through menopause, their hormones are changing. That can lead to a depression. Also, thyroid. If a patient comes to me and they're complaining of depressive symptoms, one thing that I will do is ask them if they have had their thyroid checked. If not, then they're going to go get it checked. The reason is because a low thyroid can lead to depression. We see it every day in the hospital. The other thing is pregnancy. Again, hormonal changes just like in menopause. We also know that there is a genetic component, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute, as well as life events. So some of the genetic components. One thing, the reason why we know that there's a genetic component is, one, I always say this, if you have a family member who suffers from depression, then your risk is 2 to 3 times greater than that of someone who does not have a relative. Now, we know that there's a genetic component because there's been studies done on identical twins and non-identical twins. And in an identical twin whose genetic makeup is the same, if one of them has depression, there's a 50% chance that the other one will have it as well. In non-identical twins, the rate's about 20%. We also have done studies to show about a child who's been adopted into another family, because some people will say, well, is there an environmental component? We know that there is, but we also know that there's more of a genetic as well because of the adoption studies that are done. So let's say that a woman who has a history of depression has a child. She puts the child up for adoption, and it goes to a family who there's no depression. Nobody in the family is ever depressed. That child still has an increased risk of depression, despite the fact that they're in a home without it. Does that make sense? Okay. So again, we talk about the major life events. Trauma, especially in childhood, puts the person at an increased risk. Financial stressors, unemployment. We'll see also limited social support. For those who are not married, although some would say that stress is enough to cause them to be depressed, it's actually the opposite, to where those who live alone, have no social support, no family, are at an increased risk just because of the solitude. Low socioeconomic status, so those in the poverty level are at increased risk, and I think it's contributed to a lot of different things. Financial stressors, sometimes they're more sickly because they can't afford to go to the doctor. So there's a lot of factors that go into this, but these are just some of the main ones. Gender. Up to 25% of every female will suffer from depression at some point in their life. Substance abusers, drug and alcohol. Alcohol is a huge one that we see a lot in the hospital. 30% of them will suffer from depression. And previous episodes. So what this means is I will have patients come in. They were depressed. We treated them. They're doing better. Then they come back to me a couple of months later, and they're saying, well, am I going to have to be on meds for the rest of my life? Well, I always tell them that, you know, if this is their first episode, I'll say, well, you know, what we can do is after 6 months or so, we can try to take you off of the medicine, see how you do. But there's a 50% chance that if you've had one episode, male or female, that you'll have another episode. Now, when that is, who knows? But there's a 50% chance. Now, my rule of thumb is 3. If a patient comes to me and they've been treated, they got better, we took them off the meds, then they've relapsed. If they've done that 3 times, then I say that they need to be on it lifelong. Obviously, it's the patient's choice, but that's the rule, is 3. And again, keep in mind that mental illness is not something people choose to do. I've actually had spouses come in with their loved one and say, she just needs to suck it up. She just needs to get off that couch and just feel better. And it doesn't work like that. It really is a chemical imbalance that people do not choose to have. But the good news is it's treatable. So if you treat the chemical imbalance, then they go on and they live a normal life. But again, you know, for some people, they're like, I just don't want to be on medicine for the rest of my life. But if they had diabetes, high blood pressure, or any other illness, if they didn't take their medication, they would end up in the hospital. And a lot of times that's what happens with the depression as well, if they don't take their meds. Age is also a risk factor. Depression can affect every age group. But as we get older, you have an increased risk of depression. And there's a lot of factors that go into that as well. Specifically, you know, they start losing spouses and sometimes even children, and they're alone. And there's just a lot of factors that go on into that. But we do know that there's an increased risk in the elderly. So why do we care? We care because 24 million Americans each year suffer from depression. That's actually more people than suffer from cancer or coronary artery disease. So that is a very large number of Americans that are suffering, and they don't have to. 15% of all Americans will suffer from depression at some point in their life. 30% will attempt suicide. And of that 30%, 50% of those 30 will succeed. In 2011, over 39,500 people committed suicide in America. It is the 4th leading cause of death in ages 15 to 64. And it's the 10th leading cause overall. Male is more than female, and females will attempt more, but males succeed more. And this is very startling every time I read it, despite the fact that I've read it many times, is 39,500 people committed suicide. For every one of those, 8 to 25 other people attempted. They just weren't successful. That's almost a million people if you use the 25 per year. Another thing to note is that 90% of those who commit suicide have a diagnosable psychiatric illness, and 60% of those are depressed. And I only mention that because it just shows the importance of getting them help. If substances like alcohol are involved, alcohol specifically, 75% of those have depression. And again, why do we care? It's because it's treatable. People are suffering and they don't have to. It's kind of like if you had a heart attack, would you not go get treatment? Or if you had, you know, a stroke, would you not go get treatment? And obviously that's more sudden, but still it can affect you if you let it continue. So treatment, I always have family members will call me and they'll say, you know, my family member just won't go to the hospital, what do I do? They're saying they're going to kill themselves. If you absolutely cannot get them to the emergency department, call 911, because they will make them go, at least get evaluated. Now, obviously, that would not be the ideal situation. The ideal situation is that you speak with your family member and that you can maybe get them in with a psychiatrist. Now, I can tell you that most psychiatrists have at least a 3-month wait to get in to see them, which is obviously a barrier to care, because by the time the family's saying, look, we've got to do something, you can't really wait 3 months. And so remember the emergency department. Also, remember your local primary care doctor. Primary care physicians often, just family practice doctors, will often start an antidepressant for someone. And then that'll buy you time until you can get them to see a psychiatrist. Now, another thing that I want to say is sometimes family members will often just kind of shrug off, oh, she says she has to kill herself all the time. Don't ignore that, because if they're saying it, there's a reason and they thought about it. And some patients, family members will come to me and say that they even have a plan. And so that's when it's even getting more serious. But just because they don't tell you the plan doesn't mean they don't have one. Another thing is there's medications. SSRIs are one of the common ones, first-line treatment for depression. Now, one of the problems with the SSRIs and any of the ones that treat depression is that they take some time to work. And I always mention this whenever I speak about depression, because patients will, sometimes they go to a doctor and the doctor's busy and maybe they don't explain everything like maybe they should, but SSRIs can take 6 to 8 weeks to get the full benefit. Now, that doesn't mean any benefit. It's basically like you start the medication and then you start getting better, 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 and then at 7 weeks, that's as good as you're going to get on that dose. Now, that may mean that that's as good as you need to be. You may be doing great. But I always mention this because sometimes patients will go to a family doctor and they're not told this, and then they'll call 2 days later and say, I'm not feeling any better. Well, we wouldn't expect them to. Well, and another reason why this is important to know is because you don't want to wait until you're so desperate that you're having suicidal thoughts or your family member's having suicidal thoughts before you get them help. Because again, the medications that treat it, 6 to 8 weeks to work fully. So that means that in that time, they're going to need to be monitored, watched, and sometimes hospitalized just to ensure their own safety. Another very popular treatment is ECT. It scares people. Don't watch the YouTube videos that mock it, because it's not like a lot of people see in the movies from years ago. ECT is a very effective treatment. It's a quick treatment. It's usually quicker than waiting on the antidepressants. And it's basically, I always describe it as kind of a chemical reboot of the brain. A seizure is induced. And patients come out of it, and it's truly a miracle to see. And it usually takes a couple treatments. But we do it at Brookwood. And it's actually also done on pregnant women in certain situations. And I only mention that because it does tell you about its safety component. Now, we don't do it on every pregnant woman, obviously, but if the benefit outweighs the risk, we do. And psychotherapy, I don't do therapy, but I am a firm believer in therapy. I do medication management, but I refer many of my patients for therapy because I know that it works. And medication plus therapy is where you get the most benefit. And again, that's because the therapist will teach you ways to deal with whatever it is that could be causing or compounding the depression. And one thing too that I always mention is if you ever do therapy, it's gonna be very important that you have open communication with your therapist. I'll have patients come and say, I quit going to therapy because I didn't like my therapist. And then I said, well, what didn't you like about it? And they said, well, I just wasn't getting anywhere. And I'm like, well, did you tell her? And they'll say, no, they just stopped it. And it's very important that you be very open and direct. If there's ever a person you need to be direct with and that you like, it's your therapist and your psychiatrist, okay? If you don't feel like something's going right, you need to say something, because otherwise they're just going to keep going through the motions, assuming that you're getting something out of it and you're not. And then patients just stop going, and then it's just really counterproductive. And that is actually it. I speak very fast, so I hope everybody got it. If not, it will be recorded, as she said. Here are just some of the resources that are available. There are tons of information about how you can help identify depression, help your family members, help yourself on these websites.